Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about the water crisis with Karen Piper. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 8, with the sentence endings, A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Karen Piper, thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat with me today.
Thanks for having me.
We currently hear a lot about the world's water crisis, but at the beginning, can you maybe help me out a little bit about the science of it? Because, I mean, there must be the same amount of water on the Earth as there was 500 years ago. So where is the problem?
Scientists like to say that there's the same amount of water on the Earth as during the time of the dinosaurs, and that we are literally drinking the same water that the dinosaurs drank. And so there's the problem is not that water is disappearing. The problem is that we don't have enough clean water. So if you look at the planet, it's like over 70% of the planet is made of water. But less than 1% of that water is fresh. And then the question is, what are we doing to that fresh water? So the water problems we're having today have to do with pollution a lot, but also with climate change, which is moving where water is, and then also groundwater over-extraction. Like, we're draining these fossil aquifers that have taken like thousands of years to accumulate, and so those won't come back. And so we're getting an increase now in salt water because of all of these things, but a decrease in clean, drinkable water.
I'm interested in the international rules governing water use. I mean, what international water cooperation is there? What international bodies do they have international rules?
They do, but they don't work for the benefit of protecting water. They work against protecting clean water. So, for instance, you have the WTO, and that treats water as a World Trade Organization, which treats water as a commodity. So their main rule regarding water is that you should be able to trade it. And so you can't have national regulations protecting your water supplies. And this has become an enormous issue in Canada, because right now there are a lot of corporations from the United States wanting to tap, from all over the world, wanting to tap into Canada's water supplies. And Canada doesn't want that to happen. But right now, this is another, international organization is NAFTA, which is saying that we need to allow free trade. And so they're trying to fight that right now, and we'll see what happens with that. Now there's a new regulation at the UN that is a good one, the UN has declared water as a human right. And what that means is yet to be seen. But essentially, now if water is not supplied in an adequate level to people, those people can sue and demand that it be, that the government supply water to people. And, we'll see if that actually happens. People are already doing this all over the world. And because it's a very new resolution at the UN, we haven't quite seen the results of it yet.
I think when you were talking about this, you were... Karen Piper, thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat with me today.
Thanks for having me.
We currently hear a lot about the world's water crisis, but at the beginning, can you maybe help me out a little bit about just about the science of it? Because, I mean, there must be the same amount of water on the Earth as there was 500 years ago. So where is the problem?
Scientists like to say that there's the same amount of water on the Earth as during the time of the dinosaurs, and that we are literally drinking the same water that the dinosaurs drank. And so there's the problem is not that water is disappearing. There's the problem is that we don't have enough clean water. So if you look at the planet, it's like over 70% of the planet is made of water, but less than 1% of that water is fresh. And then the question is, what are we doing to that fresh water? So the water problems we're having today have to do with pollution a lot, but also with climate change, which is moving where water is, and then also groundwater over-extraction. Like, we're draining these fossil aquifers that have taken like thousands of years to accumulate, and so those won't come back. And so we're getting an increase now in salt water because of all of these things, but a decrease in clean, drinkable water.
I'm interested in the international rules governing water use. I mean, what international water cooperation is there? What international bodies sort of, yeah, do they have international rules?
They don't work for the benefit of protecting water. They work against protecting clean water. So, for instance, you have the WTO, and that treats water as a World Trade Organization, which treats water as a commodity. So their main rule regarding water is that you should be able to trade it. And so you can't have national regulations protecting your water supplies. And this has become an enormous issue in Canada, because right now there are a lot of corporations from the United States wanting to tap, from all over the world, wanting to tap into Canada's water supplies. And Canada doesn't want that to happen. But right now, this is another, you know, international organization is NAFTA, which is saying that we need to allow free trade. And so they're trying to fight that right now, and we'll see what happens with that. Now there's a new regulation at the UN that is a good one, that is, the UN has declared water as a human right. And what that means is yet to be seen. But essentially, now if water is not supplied in an adequate level to people, those people can sue and demand that it be, you know, that the government supply water to people. And, you know, we'll see if that actually happens. You know, people are already doing this all over the world. And because it's a very new resolution at the UN, we haven't quite seen the results of it yet.
I think when you were talking about this, you were...
Task 2. You are going to listen to part of an interview about the future of children's books. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 8 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
If you have kids, you get told over and over, limit their screen time. And you're also told, instead of screen time, get them reading more, which is all well and good, except that these days many children do their reading on a screen, which raises some interesting questions about how children read today and what direction things are headed in children's book publishing. To help us out, we've called Dan Poynter. He's the author of The Self-Publishing Manual and 126 other books. He says kids are still reading traditional printed books, but 13% of children's book sales are now e-books, and that number is rising.
And by the way, 11 million parents have purchased an e-book, and 19.6 million parents plan to buy an e-book, so the numbers are huge.
Which makes sense. Kids like to look at screens. But that's not the only reason e-books are flooding the market. They're also way cheaper to produce.
Printing and transporting paper is very expensive, and e-books eliminate the expensive four-color printing, the higher quality paper, the ocean shipping, the customs clearance, the inventory, answering the telephone, writing up the orders, picking, packing, and shipping, and managing all of these functions. So we eliminate a huge number of costs and the chance that those books won't sell.
All of that means Dan is not optimistic about the future of printed books.
Run a test. Give a five-year-old a printed book and an iPad and see what happens. That five-year-old is going to go right for the iPad. They're not intimidated by it. They know what to do with it. They'll start searching around. And in a children's e-book, you can have links to kids-safe encyclopedias. So if they click on the lion, it takes them to Africa and tells them all about lions. So now the e-book is educational.
Not all authors are embracing the new technology. One who is, wholeheartedly, is Roxy Monroe. She had written traditional children's books for years, mostly search and find books, maze books, that type thing. And then,
about 5 years ago, I got an email fan letter from a guy in the Netherlands who had a five-year-old son. And he loved the app book, the maze books. And about 18 months ago, I got an email from the fellow again who owns a graphics company, and he wanted to dip his toes into apps and thought that my books would be perfect.
When you first saw, you know, your book that you were used to seeing as a printed book, when you first saw the electronic version, what did you think? What was your reaction?
I just loved it. I mean, I just thought that that's what it should be, have been all along.
I want to ask you, we were taking a look here at one of the apps you have out. This is called Doors. It was originally a printed book that you created. And the printed book, I assume it was a kind of a lift the flap type book. You could open the door that way. Is that right?
Yes, paper engineered.
Lift the flaps and step through doors into wonderful worlds that you can explore.
That sizzling sound is the space shuttle door opening up. And then the door there opens up to the fire station.
Think of sirens. Think of red. Call the station, someone said. Find a flashlight and a glove. A first aid kit that's stored above.
You see a guy coming down a pole. A dog barks.
And look for a hat and an apple, too.
And the child's able to actually, they're moving their finger across the screen and picking where they want to go next and finding objects.
They can make the horn blow or the lights come out.
Now, Roxy admits not all children's books lend themselves to e-versions.
For example, studies have been done where if it's just a story and you're reading it, but some things are animated that aren't pertinent to the story and the child gets distracted just touching everything, they have found that they actually retain less of the story and read it less well.
Oh, really?
So it really depends upon the content and what the book is all about.
So might there be a future, even a bleak one, for old-fashioned printed kids' books? If you have kids, you get told over and over, limit their screen time. And you're also told, instead of screen time, get them reading more, which is all well and good, except that these days many children do their reading on a screen, which raises some interesting questions about how children read today and what direction things are headed in children's book publishing. To help us out, we've called Dan Poynter. He's the author of The Self-Publishing Manual and 126 other books. He says kids are still reading traditional printed books, but 13% of children's book sales are now e-books, and that number is rising.
And by the way, 11 million parents have purchased an e-book, and 19.6 million parents plan to buy an e-book, so the numbers are huge.
Which which makes sense. Kids like to look at screens. But that's not the only reason e-books are flooding the market. They're also way cheaper to produce.
Printing and transporting paper is very expensive, and e-books eliminate the expensive four-color printing, the higher quality paper, the ocean shipping, the customs clearance, the inventory, answering the telephone, writing up the orders, picking, packing, and shipping, and managing all of these functions. So we eliminate a huge number of costs and the chance that those books won't sell.
All of that means Dan is not optimistic about the future of printed books.
Run a test. Give a five-year-old a printed book and an iPad and see what happens. That five-year-old is going to go right for the iPad. They're not intimidated by it. They know what to do with it. They'll start searching around. And in a children's e-book, you can have links to kids' safe encyclopedias. So if they click on the lion, it takes them to Africa and tells them all about lions. So now the e-book is educational.
Not all authors are embracing the new technology. One who is, wholeheartedly, is Roxy Monroe. She had written traditional children's books for years, mostly search and find books, maze books, that type thing. And then,
about 5 years ago, I got an email fan letter from a guy in the Netherlands who had a five-year-old son.
Huh.
And he loved the app book, the maze books. And about 18 months ago, I got an email from the fellow again who owns a graphics company, and he wanted to dip his toes into apps and thought that my books would be perfect.
When you first saw, you know, your book that you were used to seeing as a printed book, when you first saw the electronic version, what did you think? What was your reaction?
I just loved it. I mean, I just thought that that's what it should be, have been all along.
I want to ask you, we were taking a look here at one of the apps you have out. This is called Doors. It was originally a printed book that you created. And the printed book, I assume it was a kind of a lift the flap type book. You could open the door that way. Is that right?
Yes, paper engineered.
Lift the flaps and step through doors into wonderful worlds that you can explore.
That sizzling sound is the space shuttle door opening up. And then the door there opens up to the fire station.
Think of sirens. Think of red. Call the station, someone said. Find a flashlight and a glove. A first aid kit that's stored above.
You see a guy coming down a pole. A dog barks.
And look for a hat and an apple, too.
And the child's able to actually, they're moving their finger across the screen and picking where they want to go next and finding objects.
They can make the horn blow or the lights come out.
Now, Roxy admits not all children's books lend themselves to e-versions.
For example, studies have been done where if it's just a story and you're reading it, but some things are animated that aren't pertinent to the story and the child gets distracted just touching everything, they have found that they actually retain less of the story and read it less well.
Oh, really?
So it really depends upon the content and what the book is all about.
So might there be a future, even a bleak one, for old-fashioned printed kids' books?
Task 3. You are going to listen to an interview about computer games. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
estimates state that over a billion of us are gamers, with many people playing on average 8 hours a week on their consoles. But why are games so popular? And should we be worrying about what our games are doing to our brains? I caught up with psychologist Dr. Mark Coulson from the University of Middlesex, London.
I think play is ubiquitous. Everybody likes to play. In fact, it's not just our species that enjoys playing. Lots of other species seem to engage in play. Scientists have recently decided that geckos like to play. Play serves a function. It enables us to learn new skills, explore new ways of handling old challenges, and perhaps learn new techniques for new challenges as well.
And in terms of video games, I mean, they've become wildly, wildly popular. What is it about video games in particular that people seem to really like?
I think at least part of the attraction of video games is the notion of play. They offer us a fantastic environment in which we can play. But we also know that people play games for lots of different reasons. So some people like to explore other realities. Other people like games for their social content. Other people like them because they enjoy encountering every single thing you can encounter in the game, gaining every power you can gain in the game. Other people like them because of a sense of mastery or power over other individuals. I think there are also design elements to games, and some of these designers have hit upon by accident, others they've deliberately put into games. So, for instance, if we go right the way back to Pavlov's dogs, what we know about conditioning is if you want to condition an individual to engage in behavior that they're not subsequently going to stop performing, then the best way to do it is to intermittently reinforce them. So you don't reinforce them every time they engage in the behavior, you just reinforce them occasionally. Now, games actually tend to do this. If you're playing a game where you have to go off and kill monsters or something to collect treasure, and there are particular items of treasure that you have to collect, then the monsters won't drop that treasure every single time you kill them. So you're being intermittently reinforced. So there are certain sort of behavioural design principles that go into games.
And can games actually be addictive? You do hear stories about people who just play games endlessly and, you know, start to ignore the other functions of their life.
I think that's a really interesting question. First of all, I think we've got to distinguish between addiction and dependence. So when we talk about addiction, we really mean a psychological need. This is not a physical or a biological need. However, if anything is enjoyable, anything at all, whether it's video games, chocolate, TV, or whatever, you can become addicted to it. So there is always going to be a danger there. There are, I think, some quite serious problems with assessing gaming addiction. A lot of the work that's been done in this area is focused on adapting measures of gambling addiction and trying to apply them to gaming. One of the difficulties with this area is if you're asking people about gambling addiction, you may ask them questions like, how much of the time when you're not gambling do you spend thinking about gambling? Obviously, if you endorse a question like that, that's potentially problematic. Gaming is a little bit different, though. A lot of gamers will spend time out of the game thinking about the game itself. But this is often very productive work. This is cognitive work. This is people thinking about how they can overcome challenges. So from a psychological perspective, it might actually be quite healthy if you simply use these kind of measures that are used to assess gambling addiction and apply them to gaming addiction. You tend to overestimate the extent of the problem.
In terms of some of the other potential risks of gaming, the media sometimes talks about perhaps violent video games, you know, the shoot 'em ups. Do they encourage violent behaviour? What's the current thinking on that?
The current thinking is a little bit controversial. I think it's important to note that we don't have definitive answers. Indeed, I don't think there will necessarily be definitive answers. We are not entirely sure always what we mean by violence in a game. It's very difficult to define what we mean by violent behaviour. When we look at the literature, then what becomes fairly apparent is that the
Some estimates state that over a billion of us are gamers, with many people playing on average 8 hours a week on their consoles. But why are games so popular? And should we be worrying about what our games are doing to our brains? I caught up with psychologist Dr. Mark Coulson from the University of Middlesex, London.
I think play is ubiquitous. everybody likes to play. In fact, it's not just our species that enjoys playing. Lots of other species seem to engage in play. Scientists have recently decided that geckos like to play. Play serves a function. It enables us to learn new skills, explore new ways of handling old challenges, and perhaps learn new techniques for new challenges as well.
And in terms of video games, I mean, they've become wildly, wildly popular. What is it about video games in particular that people seem to really like?
I think at least part of the attraction of video games is the notion of play. They offer us a fantastic environment in which we can play. But we also know that people play games for lots of different reasons. So some people like to explore other realities. Other people like games for their social content. Other people like them because they enjoy encountering every single thing you can encounter in the game, gaining every power you can gain in the game. Other people like them because of a sense of mastery or power over other individuals. I think there are also design elements to games, and some of these designers have hit upon by accident, others they've deliberately put into games. So, for instance, if we go right the way back to Pavlov's dogs, what we know about conditioning is if you want to condition an individual to engage in behavior that they're not subsequently going to stop performing, then the best way to do it is to intermittently reinforce them. So you don't reinforce them every time they engage in the behavior, you just reinforce them occasionally. Now, games actually tend to do this. If you're playing a game where you have to go off and kill monsters or something to collect treasure, and there are particular items of treasure that you have to collect, then the monsters won't drop that treasure every single time you kill them. So you're being intermittently reinforced. So there are certain sort of behavioural design principles that go into games.
And can games actually be addictive? You do hear stories about people who just play games endlessly and, you know, start to ignore the other functions of their life.
I think that's a really interesting question. First of all, I think we've got to distinguish between addiction and dependence. So when we talk about addiction, we really mean a psychological need. This is not a physical or a biological need. However, if anything is enjoyable, anything at all, whether it's video games, chocolate, TV, or whatever, you can become addicted to it. So there is always going to be a danger there. There are, I think, some quite serious problems with assessing gaming addiction. A lot of the work that's been done in this area is focused on adapting measures of gambling addiction and trying to apply them to gaming. One of the difficulties with this area is if you're asking people about gambling addiction, you may ask them questions like, how much of the time when you're not gambling do you spend thinking about gambling? Obviously, if you endorse a question like that, that's potentially problematic. Gaming is a little bit different, though. A lot of gamers will spend time out of the game thinking about the game itself. But this is often very productive work. This is cognitive work. This is people thinking about how they can overcome challenges. So from a psychological perspective, it might actually be quite healthy. If you simply use these kind of measures that are used to assess gambling addiction and apply them to gaming addiction, you tend to overestimate the extent of the problem.
In terms of some of the other potential risks of gaming, the media sometimes talks about perhaps violent video games, you know, the shoot 'em ups. Do they encourage violent behaviour? What's the current thinking on that?
The current thinking is a little bit controversial. I think it's important to note that we don't have definitive answers. Indeed, I don't think there will necessarily be definitive answers. We are not entirely sure always what we mean by violence in a game. It's very difficult to define what we mean by violent behaviour. When we look at the literature, then what becomes fairly apparent is that the
Task 4. You are going to listen to Jessa Gamble talking about sleep behavior. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Let's start with day and night. Life evolved under conditions of light and darkness, light and then darkness. And so plants and animals developed their own internal clocks so that they would be ready for these changes in light. These are chemical clocks, and they're found in every known being that has two or more cells, and in some that only have one cell. I'll give you an example. If you take a horseshoe crab off the beach and you fly it all the way across the continent and you drop it into a sloped cage, it will scramble up the floor of the cage as the tide is rising on its home shores, and it'll skitter down again right as the water is receding thousands of miles away. It'll do this for weeks until it kind of gradually loses the plot. And it's incredible to watch, but there's nothing psychic or paranormal going on. It's simply that these crabs have internal cycles that correspond usually with what's going on around it. So we have this ability as well, and in humans, we call it the body clock. You can see this most clearly when you take away someone's watch and you shut them into a bunker deep underground for a couple of months. People actually volunteer for this, and they usually come out kind of raving about their productive time in the hole. So no matter how atypical these subjects would have to be, they all show the same thing. They get up just a little bit later every day, say 15 minutes or so, and they kind of drift all the way around the clock like this over the course of the weeks. And so in this way, we know that they're working on their own internal clocks rather than somehow sensing the day outside. So fine, we have a body clock, and it turns out that it's incredibly important in our lives. It's a huge driver for culture, and I think that it's the most underrated force on our behavior. We evolved as a species near the equator, and so we're very well equipped to deal with 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness. But of course, we've spread to every corner of the globe. And in Arctic Canada, where I live, we have perpetual daylight in summer and 24 hours of darkness in winter. So the culture, the Northern Aboriginal culture, traditionally has been highly seasonal. In winter, there's a lot of sleeping going on. You enjoy your family life inside. And in summer, it's almost manic hunting and working activity, very long hours, very active. So what would our natural rhythm look like? What would our sleeping patterns be in the sort of ideal sense? Well, it turns out that when people are living without any sort of artificial light at all, they sleep twice every night. They go to bed around 8 p.m. Until midnight, and then again they sleep from about 2 a.m. until sunrise. And in between, they have a couple of hours of sort of meditative quiet in bed. And during this time, there's a surge of prolactin, the likes of which a modern day never sees. The people in these studies report feeling so awake during the daytime that they realize they're experiencing true wakefulness for the first time in their lives. So cut to modern day, we're living in a culture of jet lag, global travel, 24-hour business, shift work, and you know, our modern ways of doing things are, you know, have their advantages, but I believe we should understand the costs. Thank you. Let's start with day and night. Life evolved under conditions of light and darkness, light and then darkness. And so plants and animals developed their own internal clocks so that they would be ready for these changes in light. These are chemical clocks, and they're found in every known being that has two or more cells, and in some that only have one cell. I'll give you an example. If you take a horseshoe crab off the beach and you fly it all the way across the continent and you drop it into a sloped cage, it will scramble up the floor of the cage as the tide is rising on its home shores, and it'll skitter down again right as the water is receding thousands of miles away. It'll do this for weeks until it kind of gradually loses the plot. And it's incredible to watch, but there's nothing psychic or paranormal going on. It's simply that these crabs have internal cycles that correspond usually with what's going on around it. So we have this ability as well, and in humans we call it the body clock. You can see this most clearly when you take away someone's watch and you shut them into a bunker deep underground for a couple of months. People actually volunteer for this, and they usually come out kind of raving about their productive time in the hole. So no matter how atypical these subjects would have to be, they all show the same thing. They get up just a little bit later every day, say 15 minutes or so, and they kind of drift all the way around the clock like this over the course of the weeks. And so in this way, we know that they're working on their own internal clocks rather than somehow sensing the day outside. So fine, we have a body clock, and it turns out that it's incredibly important in our lives. It's a huge driver for culture, and I think that it's the most underrated force on our behavior. We evolved as a species near the equator, and so we're very well equipped to deal with 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness. But of course, we've spread to every corner of the globe. And in Arctic Canada, where I live, we have perpetual daylight in summer and 24 hours of darkness in winter. So the culture, the Northern Aboriginal culture, traditionally, has been highly seasonal. In winter, there's a lot of sleeping going on. You enjoy your family life inside. And in summer, it's almost manic hunting and working activity, very long hours, very active. So what would our natural rhythm look like? What would our sleeping patterns be in the sort of ideal sense? Well, it turns out that when people are living without any sort of artificial light at all, they sleep twice every night. They go to bed around 8 p.m. Until midnight, and then again they sleep from about 2 a.m. until sunrise. And in between, they have a couple of hours of sort of meditative quiet in bed. And during this time, there's a surge of prolactin, the likes of which a modern day never sees. The people in these studies report feeling so awake during the daytime that they realize they're experiencing true wakefulness for the first time in their lives. So cut to modern day, we're living in a culture of jet lag, global travel, 24-hour business, shift work, and our modern ways of doing things are, have their advantages, but I believe we should understand the costs. Thank you.
This is the end of the listening test.